Welcome back to Shattering This. I am appalled that Erdogan, King Abdullah, and the Ayatollah Khomeini could all announce this week that Muslims need to start focusing their attention on the prime objective, which was to obliterate Israel. And there wasn't a single mainstream media outlet that either that covered any one of the three statements or connected them. Glenn, when I think of just how ignorant that is, just how prejudiced that is, in an area that is literally life and death to the world. I mean, we're talking about the obvious makings of World War III, and no one in the media cared enough to cover any one of those three speeches.
Well, that's because the media is Jewish controlled.
Says the conspiracy theorist, right?
Right. Well, the one thing I wanted to say to IQ about the Quran being Zionist.
Yes.
Well, I was born in 1960, so I don't much remember the Six Days War, but I certainly remember the Kippur War. And I have to say in 73, 74, yeah, 74.
Right.
Somebody didn't get the memo. You know, I mean, if the Quran is Zionist, and I do Muslim wars against Israel, somebody didn't get the memo.
I love IQ to death. I just think he is a great, great guy. And he is obviously beautifully informed. IQ has some funny peculiarities as it relates to his approach. And he recognizes what the Quran says in various places about Jews in Israel. And so he wants to convince Muslims, since he grew up a Muslim in Iraq, that their Quran actually says that Israel belongs to Jews. But the Quran also says that Jews are apes and swine, and that Allah turned the Jews' faces into their asses, and that you get extra bonus points with Allah for killing Jews, and that Allah constantly brags about terrorizing the Jews so that you could rape their women, so that you could enslave their children, and you could steal their homes as a Muslim. And so, while, yes, there are some statements that if you were a rational Muslim, you would say, well, I guess we shouldn't be going against Israel. We ought to get the memo. The fact is that most of the Quran is more anti-Semitic than is Hitler's Mein Kampf.
Well, those sound like some conciliatory statements that may have been put in there well after Yathra and stuff like that. You know?
Yeah, well, the purpose of all of that was that there's a period of time where much of the Quran is nothing but a twisted version of the Talmud. I mean, there's an entire surah about the Queen of Sheba and a glass community and how there were negotiations and a whole story. It's a Talmud story. And almost the entire story made it into the Quran directly out of the Talmud. I mean, every character that has any semblance with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms became part of the Quran because rabbis in Yathrib sold Muhammad Talmud readings. I mean, Muhammad was desperate. Once he left Mecca, and in Mecca he could use the Hanif recitings from Yemen. And once he had plumbed the full wealth of those and twisted them to serve his new religion, once he had twisted every pagan belief system of the Meccans and repositioning them as Islam. Once he ran out of the never-ending argument because he was no longer in Mecca, he was desperate. And he wasn't very creative. So he bought Talmud recitals from the rabbis in Yathrib, and he twisted and bastardized them to create some part of some credence for his Quran.
Right, and which gave him some street cred to characterize it as an Abrahamic religion. And to this day, people are still saying it's an Abrahamic religion.
Right. And yet the Abraham in the Quran is based entirely on the Abraham in the Talmud. It's not based on the Abraham in the Torah. In fact, the story that makes its way into Quranic folklore of Abraham going and breaking the idols, except taking the axe to the idols and breaking all of them except the larger one, is a Talmudic story.
Right. What a mess.
Yeah, what really happened, and then there's all sorts of Quran statements where Allah, which is just Muhammad, rails against the Jews and said, you know, the Jews are deserving of death because they want to be paid back for the loans they gave the Muslims and for they want to be paid for their Talmud recitals, and Muhammad didn't want to pay them anymore. And particularly because when Muhammad, and this, it's so obvious when you read the Quran in chronological order, that Muhammad was twisting these Talmud stories to create his Quran, and the Jews were just laughing at him, laughing out loud, and said, wait a minute, that's a Talmud story. You didn't get that from Allah, and you got it all wrong. I mean, you can't even remember the story as we told it to you. And so they were mocking him, and that's really what caused the great animosity between Muslims and the Jews. That's why he turned on him.
And in spite of all the confusion, in light of all this, what I find amazing, I listen to people speculating about what's going to happen in the world, or what could happen in the world, if we would all just kind of, you know, get together, if we would pursue the right problem solutions, right solutions to the problems facing us, or if we were to do this or that. And it is what amazes me is in terms of people. If you acknowledge the authority of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and especially the prophets, we know what's going to happen. Why are people spending? So I hear people speculating about, you know, extinction level events or new ages of going to the stars and all the extremes in between.
Right.
And if we could fix Fukushima, if we did this, we could, you know, we could fix the Middle East if we did that. We know Yahweh has told us. I listen to people say, why are you? And it's funny because they're gonna twist in the wind, and they're gonna, you know, you've got Obama who has all these Muslims in his advisory positions, having to come to a point today where he finally decides to send in two F-18s and an airstrike because the situation is so egregious that if he doesn't do something, he's going to have this, you know, horrific bloodbath.
That's not why he did something. But let's be honest. There's only one reason that Muhammad sent in the two F-18s and allegedly bombed an artillery position. And that is because Obama was being criticized by Cheney and all of Cheney's revisionist protestations around the country. Everything Cheney said about why we should invade Iraq turned out to be a complete and utter lie. And it was a disaster. It was a suicidal invasion that made America and the world hugely more dangerous. But Cheney is going around trying to create revisionist history and is calling the mess in Iraq, saying that it's completely Obama's fault. And there's lots of people that are buying into it, that Obama taking the troops out of Iraq is responsible for the breakup of Iraq as opposed to the original invasion, which broke Iraq. And so Obama wants to come across as, no, you know, I'm not gutless. You shouldn't blame me. I'm going to act, and here's my action. So I'm going to send in a couple of F-18s to drop some 500-pound bombs.
Okay, fine. But if I understand your disagreement with IQ about the IS, Islamic State Forces. Part of me is maybe it couldn't be remedied. But I remember that original convoy of death thing in the Iraqi war, you know, the early 90s Iraqi war. And part of me says, man, they missed an opportunity when that convoy came out of Syria and headed toward Mosul. They were all lined up in the desert, you know. Yeah. If they had wiped that convoy out, much of this wouldn't be happening. And if something isn't done, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi is going to get his caliphate. And his murky, there's some serious murkiness about his background and about what's going on and who set him up and is propping him up, you know.
I don't think there's any murkiness at all. It's that the United States armed the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria to fight Assad. And they, since a disproportionate number of them were Iraqis that were part of the Awakening program, they continued to have meetings with other members of the Iraqi Awakening program that were senior staffers.
Okay. That guy's a CIA plant, right, basically.
Yeah, that they were in fact in Iraq, the leaders of that Iraqi society before we invaded Iraq and broke it, and therefore when they had a complete union of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria with American weapons, and now with the Sunni Muslims that were part of the Awakening program, you created that union created the most formidable Islamic terrorist organization in the world. And once that was formed, there was no solution. You couldn't bomb one convoy. You couldn't. If you killed al-Baghdadi, who is now Caliph Ibrahim, it makes no difference. I mean, there isn't you could deploy the entire arsenal of American weapons, and you couldn't resolve this problem. There is no solution anymore.
Ideological underpinnings, you know.
Correct.
It's not about just
correct.
The person.
Correct. But, you know, imagine if you were the Islamic State, and you now know that you have gotten what you wanted the most. It's just like Hamas. Hamas had to shoot more rockets into Israel because Hamas has no legitimacy unless Israelis are attacking it. It's Israelis' attacks on Hamas that give Hamas legitimacy, and so they had to break the truce and send rockets back into Israel because they cease to be relevant, and the Muslims in Gaza will focus on the horrid living conditions and blame Hamas unless Hamas is rallying them to defeat Israel. The same thing is true with the Islamic State. There's nothing the Islamic State wants more than to get the United States back engaged in that war, because that turns everyone's animosity at America, and it makes the Islamic State now the head of the sword relative to Islam, and it makes them eminently more popular. I mean, we played right into their hands. Moreover, you can't bomb them anymore. Why? Because if you want to bomb the Islamic State, you have to bomb Mosul. You have to bomb Fallujah. Are we going to carpet bomb civilian communities? Welcome back to Saturday News. Just think of the stupidity of all of that. The artillery that we claim that we bombed was American artillery. It was artillery that was we gave to the Iraqi military. It was being controlled by Shiites, but the Islamic State, who were using weapons that we gave to them to fight Assad, crossed the border and captured billions of dollars worth of U.S. military hardware. So now we're using U.S. warplanes to bomb U.S. military hardware. But beyond the stupidity of all that, just think for a moment. We have Kirk joining us in addition to Glenn. Just think for a moment of the U.S. mentality. All right, so we sent in some F-18s, and they allegedly bombed some artillery, the American artillery. When that fails, and it obviously will fail, is it in America's nature to say, well, you know, that didn't work, so we're not going to have any more airstrikes? Or is it in America's nature to say, well, you know, well, that didn't work, more airstrikes? The answer is it's not the airstrikes that are wrong. It's just that we need to have more airstrikes. And when those don't work, more airstrikes. And after a while, isn't the only place they can strike the most populated areas of Iraq and Syria, where the vast preponderance of the Islamic State operatives are, and where their military hardware is? And aren't they just going to take all of the confiscated military hardware and put it in the streets of these cities, so that when America bombs them, the whole world's going to say, America, look at the carnage that you're wreaking? And if they don't do that, aren't they just going to move it back into Syria? And is America going to start flying military flights, bombing, strafing flights over Syria and enlarge the conflict? How does this turn out well? Why don't you, Kirk, you're a really smart guy. Why don't you tell me how this turns out well? Give me a scenario where it is even remotely possible that America reengaging and now running bombing missions is going to prevail.
There is no way. I mean, unless you just want to genocide or wipe out everybody. I mean, there's no way to stop it. I mean, when a guy's hiding behind skirts, who are you going to shoot?
Who are you going to shoot? Right.
I have an idea.
Okay, go ahead, Glenn.
You negotiate with their leadership and say, okay, we can't let you use it outside of Syria, but if you go back into Syria and use it against Assad, we'll back you.
And you would expect them in Iraq to say, oh, hey, that's a hell of an idea. We've taken over the entire country, with exception of a little bitty tiny slice in the extreme north, which we're about to grab control of, and Baghdad and the Shia areas in the south east. And so after all of these gains, which you're suggesting here, is they retreat back into Syria. And our motivation for doing that would be what now?
No. Well, not retreat, but ring out the offensive against Assad. You know.
Oh, a strategic redeployment.
Yeah.
Okay.
You change the direction, just like in karate.
Okay. So they were a two-bit terrorist organization in Syria, having less effect than al-Nusra, and they moved into Iraq and became the most successful, the richest, the most powerful, the best armed Islamic terrorist organization in the history of humankind. And after all of that success, you want them to go back into Syria.
Well, no, because they've had time to refresh and recruit. They've had some time for R&R, and they've got recruits. They've had time to clean their rifles and get all ready, and then they can go back in and get them.
Now, wait a minute.
Think this
through. If you send them back into Syria, and they're armed so much better now, and they take out Syria, that begins everything.
Yeah, you know, what is Syria? Kirk was being, I mean, Glenn was being facetious.
I know, but
you know, what is happening here, fellas, and this is why this is so concerning, is that there is no solution. You can't bomb them into submission. There literally is no solution for the Islamic State. This is the direct consequence of everything we've done wrong as a nation in the last 15 years. And there is no turning back at this point. There is no scenario that eliminates the Islamic State. And they aren't going to stop with Syria and Iraq. They are going to attack Lebanon. They are going to invade Jordan. They're going to continue to push the borders. And there's only a matter of time before they invade Turkey and Saudi Arabia. I mean, and by the way, when they invade those countries, it's going to be very difficult for anyone to determine what's worse, the regime in those countries or the Islamic State. I mean, you're going to have the greater of two evils at war with each other. We'll be back in a moment. So America bombed Iraq, broke the country, and unleashed a living hell on the entire region. So will bombing Iraq some more solve the problem? America bombed Libya, and now they're engaged in a gruesome civil war. So what would be the answer in Libya? Should we bomb some more?
Well, if you're John McClown,
that would be the answer. You know, but look at the world right now. I mean, you've got the heads of the three largest Islamic countries in the Middle East, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, all announcing with the head of state that the goal of Muslims has to be the annihilation of Israel. You have Syria engaged in a brutal civil war where hundreds of thousands of people have died. Now you have Iraq engaged in a horrendous civil war where Christians are being annihilated, and it's soon to be massive death perpetrated on Shia Muslims. And the only solution America can come up with is more weapons and more bombing. Look at the war in Gaza. Look at the rise of the Islamic State. Look at the Taliban being reinvigorated throughout Afghanistan. Look at Boko Haram and their civil war in Nigeria. You don't even get a peep out of them, and they still have 300 little girls that they're raping every day. Look at the Libyan civil war, where the airport's not even functional in the capital. Look at the civil war taking place in the Central African Republic in Mali. Look at the Somalian civil war. Consider the Islamic Reformation in Egypt with a military coup. Consider that Turkey is now being moved so far into the Islamic camp and so far away from the West that they're at a point of no return. Consider the fact that Iran has now been given the green light to complete its nuclear ambitions. I mean, look at the world. Yeah.
Can I throw another fly in the ointment?
Sure.
I was studying the Kashmir conflict on what's that all about in India. And
yeah, sure. Yeah, uh-huh.
And Kashmir, for those who are a little more, were as ignorant as I was, it seems to be they signed a treaty. India signed a treaty with Pakistan about the water rights to the Indus River.
Mm-hmm.
And then the population has tripled since they wrote that, which is invalid on the Muslim side anyway. Mm-hmm. But regardless, they started building dams. The Indians started building dams because, you know, the brownouts and the blackouts they've been having the last number of years, so they have more electricity as well as water. And now the report is that in Pakistan, there's water is being sold on the black market. They're just dry as a bone.
Mm-hmm.
So they moved, they claim. I don't know what the shelf life is on an atom bomb, but supposedly they have 200, and they moved them close to India, and they made a declaration. They said they will use them anytime they decide. I mean, it's not like they have to make a big decision. They kind of green-lighted it if they use it. Now, 200, or say there's only 50 of them, 50 nuclear bombs, and nobody seems to pay much attention to that one. I mean, my God.
Wait, Kirk.
Yeah. Go ahead, Glenn.
If you recall, shortly after 9/11, it kind of got lost in the sauce because of all the hoopla with 9/11. But if you recall, shortly after 9/11, they had a head-to-head thing over Kashmir back then with both sides mutually threatening to nuke each other.
Right.
And that eventually settled down. I find it hard to believe that Pakistan is like in a state of mind where, yeah, someday, you know, we reserve the right to just pop a nuke on India anytime we want now, and it'll just show up in the news.
Well, the whole situation there began, Glenn and Kirk, because the Hindus led a rebellion against the British in India.
Mm-hmm.
And when they led the rebellion and formed an independent country, the Muslims wanted the independence, but they also wanted independence from India. They wanted all the benefits that the Hindus had provided, and they wanted their own pure land. And Pakistan means pure land of Islam. And so they began to terrorize the Hindus so that the Indian says, all right, you go up there and you can just be miserable all by yourself. And then the territory that was in between that was assigned to India was Kashmir. And every state-sponsored
population.
Right. Every state-sponsored Islamic terrorist organization, with exception of the Taliban, which the Taliban was conceived to control Afghanistan, but every other Islamic terrorist organization was specifically designed to terrorize Indians in Kashmir and Hindus in Kashmir to bring Kashmir into and annex it into Pakistan. And so when I was doing the Islamic terrorism timeline through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, what I found is that the most frequent deployment of Islamic terrorism as a tactic was in Kashmir, long before the water issue even came to the forefront. When you speak about India and Pakistan and the populations, which are enormous of those two places, and the weapons that they have and the number of people they could bring against each other, you know, in Daniel 11, and I was trying to make heads or tails of this, and I haven't read anything from anybody that seems to understand who the two players are. There's the king of the north and the king of the south. And this whole episode is taking place during the tribulation, during the last days, in all likelihood, based upon the text. And you wonder, all right, king of the north, king of the south, and they're warring against each other with enormous numbers. You wonder if it could be Pakistan and India.
Yeah. So some historians try to say that that chronicles the activities of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, but that doesn't seem
to. Well, that's the old version, yeah. A lot of the Christian preachers preach that, yeah. That is the
Yeah, the only problem with that, of course, is that it's the context is that the king of the north and the king of the south continue to battle each other right up to Yahweh's return. I mean, it's right. It is absolutely, well, while it grows out of the comments of Persia and Darius, there's an immediate transition from a point in our past to a point in our future. And so to figure out who these warring individuals are, it's quite a challenge. So but I hear, you know, the Pakistan India thing. I say, well, that's certainly a north and south conflict.
And the Sikhs are certainly like the Kurds stuck in the middle. Another people being stuck in the middle of all that.
Yes.
But I have to get going. You know, so I just have to say Shabbat Shalom, and I got a super tight schedule here and head out.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Glenn. Kirk.
Yes, sir.
I'm really at a point now where there does not seem to be any means of delaying the inevitable, which is the destruction of the United States. The United States is now engaged in so many grievances. You know, we're on the wrong side in Gaza, Hamas, Israel, wanting Israel to capitulate. We're on the wrong side in the Ukraine. And we're being dragged into the Ukraine thing. It's going to cost us hundreds of billions of dollars before it's all done. There is no way for it to cost us anything less than $100 billion.
Terry and I spent the last week and a half reading Section 7, the thing she posted on the Roman Empire.
Oh, yeah.
And I was I grew up studying the Carthaginians and so forth. So
yes,
they are even more horrible than you depicted.
Yes,
your framework in the history is so much different, and because you're taking a point of view and you tell everybody what your point of view is to begin
right.
with, which historians
right.
normally don't do.
Right,
hide their point of view in the context.
Right.
But when you look at, if you would, in fact, I was thinking about this today. I didn't get on the phone quick enough to when IQ was there, but I. It's interesting how IQ was starting to ask some questions, you know, and maybe put a few cracks in the armor about Christianity that he's asking. Why do they do this? And you know, and you suggested that he read that. I would suggest that to anyone between that and questioning Paul and the Roman Empire to see where it came from, which is just Catholic Church. Christian Church just became the political Roman Empire. I mean,
yeah. Would you mind if we were to talk a little bit about those new chapters that have been posted in the seventh volume of Yada Yah? The first of those, and I want people to have an appreciation for what's there, I'm totally open to you being, by the way, critical, because those chapters are very different.
Critical. I was just saying there's a different point of view that most people would dare do. They just
right. Yeah, it's unlike anything that I've ever attempted to write before. I was translating Daniel 7 and Daniel 8.
Right.
And when you get translating Daniel 7, there is no question as to who the players are. You know, it's Babylon. Babylon is a beast. Then Persia is a beast. And then Alexander the Great's Greece is a beast. And then Rome is the ultimate beast. But there's something about Rome that we'll speak of in a moment. But God calls the Roman Empire the most vicious empire in the history of humanity. And so I went into this thinking, you know, I know that Rome did some bad stuff, but you know, there was the grandeur of Rome. When you're a child and you're being taught history and you're an educator, we're always taught about the greatness of the Republic of Rome, and there really was no Republic of Rome. And then the the Empire of Rome, which was with the emperors being gods, mm-hmm. that there was this great civilization and all of the wonderful things that contributed. But here's God saying it's the most repulsive, the most deadly, the most destructive empire in human history. So I did something I've never done before. I devoted 100 pages to a pagan civilization, and I went through. I decided I would, since God's critique against Rome was the viciousness and the deadliness of Rome, that's my perspective, and I said it right out front. God has just said this about the Roman Empire. It's so different than my prior perceptions of Rome. I want to go through, and I'm going to chronicle the battles of Rome. And we go through the battles of Rome beginning in the 3rd to 4th century BCE, all the way through the last of them, when Rome was completely destroyed. And so what I wanted you to share is it way too wearisome? Or is having an appreciation for how vicious, how deadly, how despicable, how repulsive the Romans were in their battles and in their fight for power, even against one another, is it useful? We'll be back. Conversation with Kirk, who has recently read the new chapters that are posted at yadaya.com in Volume 7. Kirk, I read Yahweh say that Rome was the most vicious, the most destructive, most deadly human institution to ever exist on Earth.
Right.
That was not my impression of Rome. And so while I have come to know Yahweh really well and know that he never exaggerates, he never deceives, I then devoted like 120 pages to the history of Rome. Of course, what he said is true. But it's the first time I've ever attempted something like that, because, you know, every book that I've ever written is, this is what God said. Let's consider the words, and let's make connections with that, and then let's go to the next thing that God said.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way this chapter is written. We do begin with what Yahweh revealed to Daniel. But then there's like 120 pages.
Well, you have to go back to Rome. Led up to make Rome what it was, you know, and how it never changed its viciousness. I mean, it was they killed each other, you know, the Etruscans and the Latins mm-hmm. and the Romans. They fought mm-hmm. each other on dominance of just the peninsula. I mean, right. you have Sparta. I mean, you have not Sparta. I'm sorry. You have the Spartacus. You have the Carthaginian Wars. You have the Etruscans, and you have the Celts that conquered the northern part. You have the my God, it's just they never stopped. When I went, I kept going down and looking up, and every time we'd go to a new town, there would be another castle on the wall. And I said, these people don't get along with anybody.
No.
They fight more than Hatfields and McCoys.
Yeah, it struck me that the Romans were the first to do what the Europeans did in North America. The Romans labeled all people other than Romans savages, and they were justified in attacking them and abusing them. Just like the colonists came to America, they labeled the native population, the Indians, savages, and thought nothing of killing them. And yet it was the Europeans that were the savages and the native people who were vastly superior. I found that to be true throughout everything I read in the Roman conflict, that mm-hmm. the Romans were the savages.
Yeah. They were empire builders. They saw the opportunity to first of all get the waterways under control. That's why they had to fight the Carthaginians, because they had the bigger navy at the time.
Right.
And then they built roads, where we build roads ostensibly to transfer goods back and forth.
Right, facilitate commerce.
Economy. They built them to send the army over to conquer the people to bring all the goods back. You know.
Yeah, that, by the way, was not the reason that our interstate system was built.
Well,
Eisenhower built the interstate system because he saw how effective the Germans were with mm-hmm. their autobahns and positioning military hardware. And so the U.S. Interstates were specifically designed to be long airports, so we could land airplanes wherever we wanted to, and we could move military hardware in the United States more effectively. That's not what they're used for now, but that's what they were designed for.
Yeah. But they sold it to us, so this is why we need
right.
the tax dollars. So.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that I found is that it became apparent that Rome was more of a stratified society than is even India today with the caste system.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that the elitist Romans, everything was for the patricians, the elitist. And that that power was given to the most vicious general almost 100% of the time. And that the elitists didn't want to work, and they wanted everybody else to work for them. They needed slaves. They needed someone to produce their food. They needed someone to pay their taxes. They didn't want to do any of these things. And they used the legions for two reasons. One is to acquire slaves, to acquire food, to acquire tribute, but also to be so ruthless that most people were afraid to stand up against them.
Right. Quell any revolt, yeah.
Right.
So, but you've hit the nail on the head in this one. I mean, Terry and I, we kind of read to one another, so we
right.
enjoy it. That way we're getting both the same thing at the same time, so we can stop right. and discuss it and everything. Now, it's heavy if you view the world as some, apple pie and mom and all that kind of stuff. If you've never read any real serious history, then you will it will shock you. Even if
yeah.
you have read a lot of it, it'll shock you. And
it'll shock you. It is shocking.
It's not as gruesome as some of the things that you can read if you really want to dig it out, you know. But the beast, the horrible beast that Yahweh describes is absolutely him.
Yeah, then there is a second and third, and I want to, if you can stay on into the next hour, I would love to be able to discuss this with you, is that there were two other reasons for chronicling Rome, because we then move into the eighth chapter of Daniel, and we learned that the beast that is Rome savages and ravages the entire world, and that the beast that is Rome is ultimately the source of the Torahless one that Christians think is the Antichrist.
Yeah.
So we'll be back in a moment.